Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano in, I guess, week three of our lockdown series. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. How about yourself?
Staying mentally sane and physically healthy as far as I can tell. We are very lucky to have a special guest this week, Frank. So do you want to do some introductions of our special guest?
Yes, we have a friend of mine and a wonderful scholar named Lindsay Chervinsky. And Lindsay works at the White House Historical Association, and she has just published a new book. In fact, I think it came out in the past week or so. She had her launch a few days ago called The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution, published by Harvard University Press. And we want to take this opportunity to talk to Lindsay about her book. So, Lindsay, welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here with you guys.
Well, it's great to have you here. So, Lindsay, do you want to just, I mean, you'll be known to many of our listeners, but let's assume for the sake of the show that you're not. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself before we get started talking about your book?
Sure. So, as you said, I work for the White House Historical Association. I'm a historian there. It is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. So, my job is to share the history of the people that lived in the space, worked in the space, and built the White House, as well as all of the crazy events that have happened and its sort of role as a complicated symbol of the nation. So that's my day job. I also am a expert on the presidency and the cabinet, and my book, as you mentioned, is about Washington's cabinet and the creation of that particular institution, because it is not in the Constitution and no legislation ever created it. So that's really my historical passion. And then outside of that, I would say the thing that I like best to share is I have a dog named John Quincy Dog Adams, who Quincy for short. He is an American foxhound and frequently shows up on my social media and is probably far more interesting than I am. So he is probably my best online content.
Yes. So if you're not following Lindsay on Twitter and other social media, you should. So when you go out in the park with Quincy, do you ever call him by his entire name when you're throwing the ball? John Quincy, John Dog Adams.
No, not usually. And frankly, I rarely call him Quincy, actually, because, you know, as we all do when we have pets, they acquire a series of just ridiculous, absurd pet names. Quincy is usually when he's in trouble. But one of his nicknames is JQDA. So if anyone picks up the book and opens the front page, it is dedicated to my husband and JQDA. So that's what that stands for.
Nice. So in terms of choosing the name of your dog, are you disclosing your Federalist preferences?
Well, so my first like really serious historical work was in college when I was doing my honors thesis, and that was on John Quincy's role in the Monroe cabinet. And I just sort of developed this fascination with his unbelievable grouchiness and his wonderful curmudgeonly like nature. But if anyone's actually read his diaries, he was really very funny. He was very witty. He was just way too smart for his own good. And something about that just really warmed my heart. And so I have a little bit of a pattern of naming pets after historical figures. My cat was named after Winston Churchill. So that was Winston Cat Churchill. So I have a little bit of a tradition going, and Quincy seemed like a really good option and like appropriately regal for a foxhound.
Okay. I was worried for a second that this was the sixth dog you had and you were just going through the line.
No, I have not done that.
I mean, one thing I would say to listeners, I mean, Lindsay's reminded me of this, but it's John Quincy Adams is, diaries are fabulous, and there is, for people who are locked down and have a lot of time on their hands, there's a new Library of America 2-volume edition edited by David Waldstreicher that's really, really good. So if you're looking for something to read, you could do a lot worse than John Quincy Adams's diaries.
Well, after you read Absolutely. Lindsay's book.
After you read Lindsay's book.
Very important addition.
Before we get what we really want is the diaries of John Quincy Dog Adams, of course, but we're still waiting for those.
Yes, right. Absolutely. I'm sure he would have a lot of opinions. He's very opinionated.
So Lindsay, How did you choose this topic for your first book?
Well, I got really lucky in that I was in my first year of graduate school, and I would say about a month in, my advisor said, okay, so what are you going to do for your dissertation, which is pretty hilarious. And I said, well, you know, I'm really interested in high politics in the early republic. I'm fascinated by the amount of influence individuals wielded over events and government, partly because the government was so small and still really evolving. I said, so I think, you know, I kind of want to do something about that and maybe look at the relationships in the first administration and the cabinet. And he said, okay, well, why don't you go read on the cabinet and come back and tell me what you think? And I spent the next couple of weeks looking for books about the institution and trying to understand where it came from, trying to understand how it emerged. And I really couldn't find anything. And so, you know, very fearfully, because I was a first year graduate student, I walked back in and I said, you know, I'm not trying to avoid the work, but I just can't find any books on this subject. And so he made a couple of recommendations about where I could look, and I came back empty handed again. And so I think he was a little annoyed with me. So he went to go look and he couldn't find anything. And so I think he said, you know, do you want to write that story? And so I really got so lucky that I stumbled onto this topic that no one had really written about, because I think everyone assumed it was already done. And I just became really fascinated by this institution that is so public and so powerful and really well known. And yet the origins were really obscure. And so I decided that I really wanted to answer that question of where did it come from and tell that story.
Oh, interesting. So in terms of the book itself, before we get to the book. So did you do your PhD dissertation on the cabinet? And then that's the origin of the book that we have before us?
Yes. So I wrote the dissertation, and it was, you know, like many dissertations, very thematic. So I had a chapter about the British cabinet, and a chapter about Washington's councils of war, and a chapter about the state councils. And then I spent the next couple of years rewriting it. I think I rewrote it 3 or 4 times, which I don't totally recommend, but that was what I had to do to get it right. And really tried to turn it into a story, because I really wanted to tell a narrative. I really wanted it to be accessible to people who don't have PhDs in history. It was really important to me. I felt like the story potentially had widespread public interest, and so I wanted to do right by it. And also, you know, I had to go back in and add the background information about, you know, Hamilton and Jefferson's relationship and all these things that my committee didn't need to know because they already knew it, but an average reader might need that information. So it definitely was a little bit of a crazy process pulling it apart sentence by sentence, but I'm glad I did, and I'm really happy with the way it turned out.
Good. So what was the biggest challenge you faced in doing the research?
So the biggest challenge that I faced, I mean, I was really lucky in that a lot of times historians are dealing with like 10 letters to try and tell a story. And I was dealing with like 10,000, because they were, you know, such avid letter writers, and they were saved because they're people like Jefferson, Hamilton, Washington, that people at the time, contemporaries, already knew that these were going to be important historical figures. And so they were able to, you know, preserve a lot of that writing. So that was really, you know, a tragedy of riches. But the challenge that I had was, after a certain number of years of researching this stuff, I started to develop a sense about why they were doing things, but they didn't always write that down. And so trying to find that middle line between saying, so like, for example, I became very convinced that they were very aware of comparisons to the British cabinet and not wanting to appear too much like the British cabinet, but they never actually wrote that down. And so I had to piece together all of this other evidence that sort of showed how they were very attentive to their reputations and their public image and attempting to appear to be virtuous Republicans. It's this little R Republicans in other walks of their life, and hope that that built up a strong enough case to suggest that maybe they were also attentive to it in the cabinet. And then I just had to say, here's all the evidence, this is what I think, but we don't know for sure because they never wrote down their thoughts or motivations on this one thing. And so I had to be okay, you know, giving my thoughts and saying that they're my thoughts and being very honest about my evidence, but not being able to say with certainty what actually was going on.
So Lindsay, the cabinet's not in the Constitution. Where did you find it actually comes from? What, I mean, you mentioned the British antecedents and whatnot, but for the Washington administration, where did the idea for having a cabinet come from?
Yeah, so this is sort of like the fundamental question of the book. So the delegates to the Constitutional Convention explicitly rejected a cabinet. There were several proposals that came up, including one that looked almost identical, and they outright rejected it because they felt like it would lead to corruption and cronyism and would really obscure responsibility at the highest levels of government. And so instead, they gave a couple of options. They allowed for the president to request written advice from the department secretaries and to consult with the Senate on foreign affairs. And so when Washington entered the presidency, he really tried to stick to those things, but for a number of reasons really felt like the Senate was a terrible advisory body because it was a legislature and they tend to move slowly. And written advice was really insufficient because it was slow and cumbersome and there were really complex issues that were facing the first administration. So when Washington finally did convene a cabinet 2.5 years into his administration, which is really important to note that it wasn't there on day one, he modeled those interactions off of the councils of war that he had convened during the Revolution, because that had been a really helpful model for him in terms of obtaining advice and support.
So who are the key people in his first cabinet? I mean, I think some of these names are pretty familiar to people.
Yeah, well, so of course there's Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, who famously duked it out in the cabinet battles in the Hamilton musical. But then
and in real life too, but
and in real life, although maybe not as much of your rap, but they definitely duked it out, and there's some just phenomenal notes where Jefferson says that Hamilton gave a jury speech for 3/4 of an hour, and it's really important to note that when that was happening, it was in a relatively small room, like 15 by 21 feet, that was full of furniture. There were 5 guys that were pretty big dudes, absolutely, you know, hated each other. It was in the middle of the summer in Philadelphia, and they're stuck in this room for hours, and Hamilton goes on for 45 minutes. And so it's just really helpful color to understand some of this background. But so those are the two that most people know. Washington, of course, was there. But then the other two, which I really try and make the argument in my book that they're important and need more historical attention, are Secretary of War Henry Knox and then the first Attorney General Edmund Randolph.
Do you have a favorite among these in terms of doing your research?
I go back and forth between Knox and Randolph. I feel like they both Jefferson's writings about them really color how people since then have viewed them. Jefferson once wrote that the cabinet usually decided 2.5 to 1.5 because Randolph was so indecisive and would go back and forth between the two different sides, which is just, you know, so Jeffersonian. But really, I mean, Randolph was trying to be unbiased and unpartisan and be a voice of reason and a legal perspective. He just wasn't as good at being unbiased and unpartisan as Washington was. And so he tended to kind of go back and forth, but he was a really important part of the cabinet, and all of the secretaries consulted with him on legal issues, even Jefferson and Hamilton, who had legal training. So I think that that's really important to note. He especially took on additional influence once he became the second Secretary of State after Jefferson retired. And he was Washington's closest advisor at that point. So I think he's really understudied. And then I have a soft spot for Knox. He, again, we're really colored by what Jefferson had to say. And Jefferson often referred to him as Hamilton's toady. And so we tend to think that he didn't have his own ideas or his own experience. And in reality, you know, he had been in the military for years before Hamilton signed up. He was there for years afterwards. He had served as the Secretary of War during the Confederation period. And he had such tremendous insight and experience about both military and Native American issues. And that was a really important contribution to the cabinet. And while he often agreed with Hamilton because they came from the same sort of military nationalistic perspective, he came to that position from his own experiences, not because he was following Hamilton's orders.
Washington really thought highly of Knox, didn't he? I mean, I think that's something that's often forgotten.
Yes, and he was, when Knox, you know, again, it's sort of the way they leave the cabinet sometimes shadows their historical legacy. Knox left for a while to go back to Maine and try and sort out some of his personal finances during the middle of the Whiskey Rebellion. And Washington was really bummed that he left and really wanted him to come back and was asking for him to come back because he valued that insight. So he is an important figure.
So how did Washington, why did he pick these handful of people to advise him? What was it? What were his, the criteria that he used for deciding who he wanted to give him advice in these times of crisis?
Yeah, he had a couple of different criteria that were really important and that have actually shaped presidential legacy since then. So first and foremost, he needed to know them and have at least a decent working relationship, which makes sense because you don't want someone advising you that you don't know or trust. Then the second thing is that they had to have advice and expertise and experience that was different than his own. And this is one of Washington's greatest leadership strengths, was that he was willing to surround himself with people that knew things he didn't, had done things he hadn't, and he sought out that advice and listened to it. So they needed to offer something that he couldn't provide. So for Jefferson, he, of course, had this diplomatic experience. He was fluent in French, which was the language of diplomacy. Washington had only left the nation once, and it was when he was a teenager to go to Barbados. So he
and famously didn't know French.
Yes, he famously did not know French, which caused a lot of problems in his presidency. So that was really important. While Washington understood the financial proposals that Hamilton came up with, he didn't have that same sort of creative mind to come up with those sort of strategies. So he needed someone who was able to sort of think through these problems and come up with good solutions. And again, Knox had this experience as the Secretary of War during the Confederation, so he had managed the relationships with Native American nations and had a lot of insight there. And Randolph was a brilliant legal mind, which Washington, of course, didn't have that training either. So that was a really important criteria. And then the third one, and this is really where the legacy comes in, he wanted to have people that represented different interests, regions, factions, backgrounds as a way to bring the nation together. So obviously they were all white dudes, so like relatively not diverse as from that perspective. But if we think about in terms of where they were from, what experiences they had had, what sort of interests they represented. So Hamilton cozied up to the merchant trade elite while Jefferson and Randolph were slave owning plantation owners. They brought a very diverse background and perspective to the cabinet. And most presidents since then have really adopted this model. And of course, our definition of diversity, has expanded since then, but have tried to bring together people from all over the nation as a way to allow people to feel that they are involved and they belong and they are represented in the administration.
So what were the big, do you have a couple of examples of like sort of set piece decisions that Washington made that were informed by his cabinet?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, in the cabinet, I have a couple of different case studies that demonstrate the cabinet's influence. One is the chapter six is the neutrality crisis in 1793 when the cabinet, Washington and the cabinet are trying to figure out how to stay out of an international war. Chapter seven is the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794. And then chapter eight looks at the debate surrounding the Jay Treaty, including Washington's assertion of executive privilege for the first time. So those are a couple of big moments. Another one that I think sometimes goes overlooked is Washington's use of the veto for the first time, which happened in 1792. And this was a moment where Hamilton and Knox kind of felt like, the legislation was fine because it kind of favored northern states. And Jefferson and Randolph said, no, it's really unconstitutional because it happened. I mean, it also happened to sort of penalize southern states. And Washington did end up vetoing it after also consulting with Madison. So that was a very particularly interesting moment. But he needed that cabinet cover because he didn't want to appear to be favoring his home state of Virginia. So having at least some of the people in the cabinet back him up, and having Madison back him up was really important.
Interesting. Of course, he's consulting all Virginians in favor of that. But...
it's true. I'm not sure he really thought of that part through, but it is pretty funny to see how that breaks down.
So the cabinet of today, or at least up until the recent past, I mean, is the institution, like all institutions, has evolved over time, but to what extent does Washington's cabinet has it influenced the cabinet through American history?
Absolutely. So towards the end of his administration, Washington actually moved away from cabinet meetings and back towards individual consultations and written correspondence. I suspect because the replacements that he had in the cabinet, I affectionately refer to them as the B team, because I think he didn't really think that they were up to snuff. And by doing so, Washington really establishes this legacy that each president gets to decide for themselves who their closest advisors are going to be, and that the cabinet doesn't have a right to be in the decision-making process. And so what we see after that is, while each president does have a cabinet and does meet with the cabinet, the relationships really look different depending on who is in office and who they value. And so each president gets to decide what those relationships are going to be, who their closest advisors are going to be, how they're going to consult them, when they're going to consult them, if they're going to listen to that advice. And all of that takes place really with very little public or congressional oversight. And so while, as you suggested, the cabinet has expanded a lot, it has institutionalized, the National Security Council has sort of taken on a large part of the responsibilities that the original cabinet had, there is this legacy that each president does get to decide for themselves. And so sometimes we see, you know, like Obama was really close to his vice president, Joe Biden, and that's actually a fairly unusual occurrence. And Kennedy was really close to his attorney general, who also happened to be his brother. Yeah. And so, you know, like, it's just really interesting to see how different people choose different advisors. And sometimes that's friends, sometimes it's family members, sometimes it's business acquaintances, and sometimes it is cabinet secretaries if they put people in the cabinet that they trust and have good relationships with. So I think that the cabinet is a reflection of a president's ability to lead, because a good cabinet really can be an amazing ambassador for the president's agenda and sort of blends into the background, and all of its strengths and successes go to the president's credit. And a bad cabinet becomes very divisive. It can undermine a president's legacy, and it all of a sudden can become very noticeable.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of, sorry, David, if I can just follow that up, apologies. I'm thinking about Washington's immediate successors, and John Adams has a kind of terrible time with his cabinet because he inherits Washington's B team and keeps them too long. I think Jefferson has a sort of relationship with his cabinet not unlike Washington's, maybe. Is that a fair characterization? Perhaps because of his experience as Washington's Secretary of State. Would you agree with that, or is that too much?
No, absolutely. So as you suggested, Adams has a terrible cabinet. He really thinks that they're going to be loyal to the office of the president, and instead they were loyal to Hamilton. And so that they tried to undermine his foreign policy, they tried to undermine his reelection campaign. It was really like one of the worst cabinets in history. And then Jefferson actually has, I would argue, one of the best. He has the least turnover in American history. They are incredibly effective as conduits to Congress and to other public relations. They're really, I mean, not all of his policies were successful, of course, but in terms of their role in implementing them, they were very loyal and very successful at, you know, working towards the same goal. And Jefferson wrote this phenomenal letter in November of 1801, where he says that they're going to model the cabinet after Washington's first term, because he drew a distinction between the first term and the second term when he thinks that Hamilton really took over in the second term. And so he definitely took what he thought were the strengths of Washington's cabinet and then applied them in his own very Jeffersonian way. And if I can make a sort of pitch, I do have an article actually coming out about this subject in the JER at some point, the Journal of American Revolution at some point. No, that's the JAR, the Journal of the Early Republic. There it is. But he, you know, so he is very then, I don't want to say manipulative, but is very careful about how he is cultivating these relationships and only convenes a cabinet meeting when he thinks it's going to be productive, doesn't want the cabinet meeting without him. So he's very crafty about how he manages his cabinet.
I noticed that when you listed the members of Washington's cabinet, you did not include John Adams as the vice president. So is the vice president excluded from Washington's cabinet?
Yes, that's correct. He attended a meeting with the secretaries in April of 1790 when Washington was on his southern tour because an issue came up sort of last minute. But he did not ever attend a cabinet meeting, at least that I have found in terms of evidence. He did not ever attend a cabinet meeting once Washington started calling them regularly.
Interesting.
I was just thinking about, you know, best and worst cabinets. Who do you think, which presidents have had the best list of supporting players, and which ones have really been hamstrung by their cabinet?
Yeah. So I would put Jefferson among the best. Lincoln, of course, had his team of rivals.
You see, I'm not quite sure I buy that the premise of Lincoln, but we'll get to that. All right, good.
yeah, we can come back to that. FDR had he changed some of his cabinet out a little bit depending on what the focus was. He had a different cabinet when he was focusing on the New Deal than he had during World War II, but he managed the cabinet incredibly well, and they were very productive sort of envoys for him. And then Eisenhower actually had a really good relationship with his cabinet. I mean, again, I distinguish between like whether or not I agree with the policies and whether or not the cabinet is good at implementing them. Hmm. And Eisenhower's cabinet was very effective. So those are some examples of presidents who have done really well with the cabinet. In terms of presidents who have not done so well, Jackson, of course, had his, you know, regular cabinet and then the kitchen cabinet after most of his cabinet quit in protest. Let's see, who else? Johnson, of course, because he tried to fire his Secretary of War, and that brought about the impeachment proceedings when he tried to fire Edmund Stanton. I would say that Kennedy's cabinet is not actually a great model because, again, he had that sort of shadow group of advisors, and that's not really ideal because it leads to a lot of confusion both publicly and within government channels. And then I think I'll stop there.
Right.
Yeah, that's
very
probably
politic of you.
Yes, I like to present all of the historical information I can and then allow people to draw their own conclusions about contemporary politics.
Well, I mean, your point about Kennedy is interesting, though, about sort of having both the official cabinet, and I guess Jackson had this too, and sort of the other team of people who mm-hmm. are around it, because it does seem, especially with the modern presidency, as if you have the formal cabinet, but then you've also got the sort of as the sort of White House staff has grown exponentially, especially in the 20th century, you have all these other people who are closer to the president in terms of actually giving him day-to-day advice than mm-hmm. the cabinet is. And that has changed the role of what the cabinet does.
You have the chief of staff now, which was not a role that existed, you know, in the Washington cabinet or these earlier cabinets as well.
Which also actually came from the military role, though, with Eisenhower, I think, isn't it?
It's definitely a modern creation. I mean, like, to a certain extent, Tobias Lear sort of managed Washington's private secretaries and would often be in charge of gathering the secretaries and occasionally would sit in on cabinet meetings, but it was much less of a powerful role than the chief of staff is today. And you're right that there are these sort of now West Wing versus cabinet power showdowns in a certain way. But, you know, I think the best administrations have found a way to weave those together successfully and to get their cabinet to work with the other people they have in the White House, which is obviously a very difficult role because the people we're talking about are incredibly experienced. They have, you know, they're probably incredibly opinionated. They might be a little bit egotistical, and, you know, they tend to have their own ideas about doing things. So it requires, it's almost an impossible task to get all of these people to work together in some ways.
And the cabinet today is huge by comparison. You know, so with the original cabinet, which, you know, four or five people can give the president advice, it's much more difficult when there are does anybody know the actual number today? But it feels like there's 20 or 25 members of the cabinet. I could be exaggerating, but it's big.
Yeah, well, so there are 15 departments, but then there are usually some additional people who sit in on the cabinet meetings. And yeah, so absolutely. I mean, it's a much larger group. And so when we see, like, even, you know, with Eisenhower, who had a fairly decent sized cabinet, he had a couple of secretaries that he was really close to. They usually tend to be the big ones, you know, like Department of State, Department of Defense, the really Department of Treasury, maybe the really important positions that wield so much authority and power. Those are the ones that ideally presidents would be close to.
Oh, this is fascinating. I mean, I could talk about this all day, but Lindsay, you launched your book in the past few days. Obviously, the circumstances are not what you envisioned when Harvard told you the book would be appearing on a certain date and you planned. I mean, right now you're meant to be on a book tour, probably. You had the launch, but you're doing all of this virtually. You did a virtual book launch last week or a few days ago. Could you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, it's definitely it's not what I expected. part of it is, like, I feel bad complaining because, like, in the grand scheme of things, I'm healthy and my family's healthy and we have food and I have a roof over my head. So, like, really I shouldn't complain. But, you know, I have also been working on this for 8 years, and it is disappointing to not have that sort of physical outcome that you were hoping. So I've done a number of things, and they say, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And boy, is that true. So I'm doing a number of virtual events, including the book launch that I had a couple of days ago. I'll be doing another one with the Kinder Institute next week. And I had booked Politics and Prose in D.C. towards the end of the month, which I was so pumped about because it's an amazing historic bookstore. Maybe that will be virtual. They're kind of taking it week by week. But I also then have started to think about, like, what are other ways that I can plan things, and what are other ways that I can be creative and entrepreneurial. So I organized a history summit, which is sort of like a online book festival. And that will be on April 25th. And so if you go to the website historysummit.com on April 25th, a bunch of videos from different authors will go live. You can go there now and see who's going to participate and see their profiles. But the videos will go live on the 25th. And then I'm hoping everyone will head over to Twitter and ask people questions, and after viewing the videos, and ask about books and history. And I'm hoping that this sort of collective action will lead to a really great, robust discussion. So that's just, like, sort of one example of things that I've tried to do to be creative and think differently about this process. Some events have been moved to the fall. Some are probably just going to get canceled, and that kind of stinks. But then one of the amazing things about it being 2020, I can't imagine doing this in 1990. It'd be so depressing. But technology is an incredible gift. And so we can do podcasts and we can do interviews and lots of things online. And so just trying to think about ways that I can bring interesting content to different groups of people and share other people's content and share other authors, and hope that it's sort of like a good collective, generous spirit. And so far, people have been really amazing and really supportive. I was a little worried that Tuesday, the launch day, was going to be a little bit disappointing, just because it did look so different than I had expected it would. And it really was not the case at all. I felt so supported and encouraged, and that was just really, really wonderful.
Oh, I noticed you did a Reddit Ask Me Anything a couple of days ago. How'd that go?
Oh, that was really fun. I think that I am sort of, like, just past the part of the millennial generation that got really into Reddit. But they have a phenomenal audience, and it is really well educated, and they ask really good questions. And so I highly recommend that experience. I did that on the morning of the book launch day and answered a bunch of questions. And I mean, some people were very honest, like, I know nothing about the cabinet. Can you tell me like very basic stuff to very detailed questions about like John Adams' role in the administration and wanting to know more about the councils of war and their influence on the cabinet. And so that was a really, really fun experience. And I highly recommend it to anyone who would be interested. And, you know, even if you're not used to Reddit, don't let that scare you away.
Frank, I think you should do this.
Okay. Why me, David?
Really, it's really fun.
Why not? Because I've already done it, Frank. That's why I'm volunteering you.
Oh, this was a setup so you could humble brag about your Reddit experience, David.
No,
you're
I'm not a Redditor, but I'm sure Lindsay had far more people interested in her topic than mine. But we need to get you on the Reddit.
Hold on, David. You just assumed, albeit correctly, that I had never done this.
Yes, I did.
Okay,
I know you pretty well, Frank. I know what, yes.
Yes, if the lockdown has taught me anything, it's the limits of my technological expertise and experience, that's for sure. So Lindsay, I've got so many things I want to talk to you about, but one thing apropos of the kind of activities you've been talking about now and your role at the White House Historical Association, you're engaged in public history and talking to the public in all kinds of ways. And to some extent, I mean, I think once we get through whatever it is, you know, this moment or this prolonged crisis that we're in, I mean, there will be something afterwards. But I'm not sure that history as a discipline is necessarily going to look the same as it did before. And the way we speak to the public and communicate will be the same. And it seems to me you're experimenting with, of necessity, as you say, all kinds of new ways to engage with the public that I think are quite exciting and important. And we, you know, we may look back on this, if I'm trying to be positive about things, and say, well, actually, this worked, you know, that this worked, that didn't, and so on. Is that your sense? Sorry, it's quite long-winded and leading question, but I guess respond to that statement. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think that we can't even begin to grasp how this is going to affect the world when we come out of it. And some of the changes we can't even begin to think about yet because, you know, innovation tends to come from crazy moments. And so who knows what people are going to come up with. But also things like, you know, remote work, I think, is going to become much more standard because a lot of people have proven that they can do it. And I think the same is true with history. I think that I have been so impressed by the audiences that I have been able to reach and their unbelievable appetite for good and complex history and wanting to know more, asking great questions, being really attentive, buying books. That's not, you know, it is not a dead field. And so I've been so thrilled that that's the case. And, you know, people come out of the woodwork and you have no idea how they get to you, but they're there. And that is a really wonderful gift. And I'm so grateful that people are actually interested in history and they're able to distinguish between, you know, like, so one of the most common questions I get is, I love Hamilton the musical. I know that it's a musical. Like, what really happened? And so they're able to distinguish between maybe what they've seen or read on TV or, you know, through various other forms of art, and they want to know the real story. And I think it's an opportunity for us as historians to think about what are some of the creative ways that we can reach people? What are some of the creative ways we can provide content? What are some of the, you know, what are the questions they're asking and how can we use those questions as opportunities to provide information, but then also, you know, I like to think of Washington as a brilliant wedge to get the conversation started. And then you can, you know, once you have the door open, you can introduce so many different facets of his life and of history because he touched so many different aspects of early American society, including slavery and Native Americans and, you know, military and culture, whatever you want. It's such a great opportunity. And so, yes, I 100% agree. I love the public aspect of my work. I love speaking to those people. I think there are a lot of really passionate listeners and readers out there. And I would encourage all historians to think about, you know, if you put in this much work to what you're doing, don't you really want people to learn about it? And so let's be creative about how we can get that information out there.
Yeah, hear, hear. I agree completely. Speaking of Washington and the study of Washington, your book comes at a very interesting time because there's been a kind of efflorescence of work on Washington, really high quality scholarship, and your book foremost among it, I think, on Washington, particularly produced by women. I'm thinking of Mary Thompson's wonderful book on Washington and slavery, which is just amazing.
It's field-changing.
Exactly. Alexis Coe's book, your book, Flora Fraser's book that won the Washington Prize a few years ago. What's going on here? Is this a coincidence? I'd be very interested in your thoughts on this as a woman who works on Washington.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for other historians, but I think that from my sense of it, and I wrote a little bit about this as well, my sense of it is that history as a field in general tended to be dominated. And this is not a newsworthy statement. It tended to be dominated by men for most of the field. And women were only really permitted into the academy in the last, you know, like as official members, as PhDs and professors and authors in the last maybe 100 years, if I'm being super generous, but probably more like 70. And so when they started to come into the field, I think naturally and rightly, there was more of a focus on social history, cultural history, women's history, because those stories really hadn't been told. And so I think the more recent generations of scholars have really done an amazing job of building off of those different approaches and revisiting stories that maybe people thought were already told and telling a different perspective. So, for example, Erica Armstrong Dunbar wrote a great book about Ona Judge and, you know, her life and her story, the way she ran away from the president's house and escaped. And that's a different aspect of Washington that we hadn't previously seen. And so without, you know, making too broad of a statement, I do wonder, and I suspect that women's slightly different perspectives, whether they're, you know, white or people of color, women have slightly different perspectives than men as both citizens and historians. And maybe that has encouraged them to think a little bit differently about other stories. That's sort of like my best guess without, you know, having super data specific evidence. But for whatever the reason, it's phenomenal and wonderful, and I'm thrilled to be a part of it. And I know that my work would have not been possible without all of the generations that came before it. And also things like there are a lot of women who do incredible work with paper editing projects. The Washington Papers, the Jefferson Papers, the Madison Papers, the Jay Papers, the Hamilton Papers. And without those projects, I think my work would have taken three times as long. And so there's just, I think, a culminating effect of all of this incredible work. And I think it's awesome and a really, really good thing for the field.
We do seem to be having a Washington moment. Or a summer of George, as Frank is saying. I was curious about, like, you know, what is about Washington. I mean, obviously, there's been tons of Washington biographies through the years, but there does seem to be a particular gravity towards him in the past couple of years, in particular. And I think obviously that reflects current needs and interests. What is it about today that sparked this interest in Washington?
Well, you're definitely right that I think it is partly a current needs and interest thing. There was a huge explosion of Washingtonia both before and after the Civil War when, you know, both the North and the South were looking for a shared history that they could both be proud of. And I do wonder at this current moment if there's a certain element of that, that people are looking for.
Oh, geez,
for
are you predicting
history.
Another Civil War? Because that last one didn't go so well.
No, but, well... I don't know. I think that there is, you know, people are looking for a history that will tell them something, that will provide hope, will provide maybe not even hope like it's a good story, but hope like, you know, we had a leader that for all of his flaws, and there were many, was able to lead the nation through a trying time. And what does that tell us about what we need in our current moment? But then I also think part of it is, you know, there have been a lot of scholars that have written about the ebbs and flows in Hamilton and Jefferson's various reputations depending on what the historical moment calls for. And Hamilton was obviously having a huge resurgence with the musical. And I think that has caused some people to think, well, like, Washington was there for all of that too, and maybe revisiting their image of him in their minds, because I think so many people think that he's this boring marble-like bust figure, and that could not be farther from the truth, and was very politically savvy, was, you know, had a temper, had a sense of humor, had emotional intelligence, was sometimes cruel, could be very harsh. So, like, there are all these elements to his personality that I think people are trying to revisit and think about ways that, you know, he might be a different person than they had considered. And I do think that the Papers Projects have facilitated that process, but certainly it is a reflection of where we are.
Huh. Okay, I think let's not forget there's institutional support now in terms of the research library at Mount Vernon and the fellowship program. You know, so just a kind of practical thing, and that's been up for about, just under a decade now, I guess. And running, and I think that's made a big difference too. I mean, I know you've held a ship there, and I have one forthcoming. And so I think there's been an institutional support as well has been important.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that their role in the way the field has changed cannot be overstated, because, as you say, they support projects on Washington, but they also take a very broad definition of what that means. And so it's really Washington's time. And that, I think, that sort of support was not necessarily there before, and absolutely has changed what scholars are able to do.
Okay, Lindsay, you must have had this question, because I get it all the time. And on one hand, you've got an answer. The gender dimension to it is a partial answer, I suppose. But do we need more books on the founding fathers? How do you justify writing, you know, on any of these people?
Sure. Well, I would say that most books yes is the short answer, but most books that people think of that were written, the history of this stuff started, you know, right after Washington died. And most of those books, no offense intended, were rubbish, because they weren't actually history by modern standards. They didn't necessarily have evidence. They were reporting myths and wildly biased stuff.
But you got cherry trees and stuff in them. They're great.
Exactly. That's a perfect example. And so, yes, while there have been a million and one books on Washington, the story of the creation of the cabinet hadn't been told. And, you know, in 1912, Henry Barrett Learned wrote a book about the legislative origins of each department. And that's the closest thing that comes to it. And of course, people had talked about the relationships. There's a book called Washington Circle on Washington's close relationships, but not the institution. And so I think it's a great example of stories we think have been told have not. And often new evidence continues to come to light all the time. Things are constantly popping up in the archives or in people's attics or being sold out of private collections. So not only is there new evidence, but the way the field has evolved and our standards for what is, you know, sophisticated and rigorous history have evolved dramatically. And so, yes, 100%, we need more books. We need new and modern takes that take into account, you know, our standards of the field and new research. And for better or for worse, people want to read this stuff. So why not give them a new and updated and, you know, important take if they're going to buy it anyway?
Right. Well, you don't have to persuade me.
Exactly. I was thinking you're like the wrong person to be asking that question, Frank. But okay.
David, do you have any more questions for Lindsay?
Well, I was just curious about your job at the White House Historical Association. I have a vague sense of what that organization does, but could you tell me more about where it came from and what its role is as an institution?
Sure. So it was founded by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961, and the mission, there was a two-part mission when she first founded it. At that point, there wasn't any institutional protection for the historic items in the White House, and there wasn't any way to really preserve those things. So each president could kind of get rid of whatever they wanted. And so she really felt like the first floor of the White House, which is called the State Floor, should be an American museum and should be a reflection of the American experience. And so started a process of collecting antiques and art and items that would be available to the American people because there would be open for tours, and really started that process. And that is a process that continues. The Historical Association continues to provide funding for the acquisition of art and other items, as well as the preservation. So, for example, during the Obama administration, we helped acquire an Alma Thomas painting, and she was the first female African-American artist to be featured in the White House, because the rules are the artist has to have passed away in order to be featured in the White House. Really? She was the first female African-American artist to be featured. And so the goal through the art is really to tell the entire experience. So both in terms of perspectives of the artists, but different landscapes and moments in history and, you know, everything you can put in different types of artistic methods, things like that. And then preserving items, like there's the Boulanger set, in which was purchased by Monroe, that is in the Blue Room. A couple years ago, we acquired the fire screen, and it was in terrible disrepair and had been in a private collection. And that is now preserved and back on the State Floor. And so there's that element of preserving the physical aspects of history. And then the other part of the mission is education and history. So sharing the full and complete story of the White House and all that it has seen and done and been to the American people. So one of the initiatives we've been working on really hard lately is called Slavery in the President's Neighborhood. And it looks at the enslaved people that built the White House and then worked and lived there. And that we feel is a really, obviously, a hugely important part of the story to tell, but is also sort of a unique perspective, because a lot of the historic plantation sites like Monticello and Mount Vernon and Montpelier are doing a great job of telling the story of the enslaved community at their site, but tend not to focus as much on the more transient populations that went back and forth to DC, and understandably so. But so that's an element of the story that we feel like we can really tell. And it's one that, you know, not as many people have focused on and is a huge part of White House history.
And do you have a favorite item in the White House that you know, when you go on tours or when you tell people to check things out when they go on tours that people should look out for next time whenever the White House is open again for tours?
Exactly. I don't know when that will be. I would be remiss if I didn't say in the meantime, there is an app that you can download that's called the White House Experience, and it does allow you to take sort of a virtual tour if you're not able to go in person.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Is it in VR? Can I have a headset and walk through the White House?
It's not VR, but it does have some pretty cool pictures, and it has information, and there's also different like thematic ones. So right now there's a thematic one about the history of the egg roll, because that's actually been around for a really long time. And
I did that as a kid. I met President Reagan.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah, I met President Reagan.
That's so interesting. But yeah, so you can definitely check out the app and you can do all the different tours. But my favorite item is there is a coffee urn thing in the green room of the White House that belonged to President John Adams. And the only reason that it actually survives, because of course the White House was burnt by the British in 1814. So the only reason this item survives is that he took it with him when he left, and he had engraved President's House on the front of it. And then it came back through an acquisition to the collection, and is now sitting proudly in the green room. And so that's one of my favorite items, because had it not gone with him, it wouldn't still be there. And so I love to see it every time I go through the green room.
And I presumably they don't serve coffee at it anymore.
No. Although, you know, it's so interesting because unlike museums like the Met or some of the Smithsonian, it is very much a living space and it is a space in use. And so, you know, when they have holiday parties, people are allowed to sit on the furniture. Oh. And so the curators are just incredible. They do a phenomenal job of preservation and taking care of things. But depending on who's going to be there, sometimes they will swap things out. So So there is a, in the Red Room, there is a sofa that was probably acquired by Dolly Madison. And it is a fairly dainty sofa and just really is not built for linebackers from colleges to come and sit on it. And so when sports teams come to the White House to celebrate their victories, they will swap out that sofa with another historic one, but one that is much more robust. And so it is pretty funny to see some of the changes to try and keep these things not broken.
That's great.
Oh, that's funny.
Because yeah. I can just imagine, you know, presidents with their families and their pets and all kinds of things, and then having to try to run the whole place as a museum. You know, those two things seem mutually exclusive as objectives.
Well, and it's not even really, most presidents and their families are pretty respectful of that space. It's people who come for the holiday parties. They don't really necessarily realize that these are the antique items. And so, like, they'll wipe their hands on the couches. And it's like, guys, that is a 200-year-old couch. What are you doing?
Oh, wow.
But it's interesting. I mean, I do something different every day. I've had the opportunity to meet a lot of really interesting people. And I am constantly learning because so many different people came to the White House. It's seen so many diplomatic and economic and social events that you can really come at it from any angle, whether it's, you know, women's suffrage or labor protests or, you know, diplomatic envoys. So I feel like I'm constantly learning and never bored. And so that's a very good thing to have.
That sounds like an amazing job. I'm envious. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Lindsay, for being with us here today. This has been really a lot of fun, and congratulations again on the book.
Yes,
thank
people,
you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And buy the book, people, The Cabinet by Lindsay Chervinsky. It's a really great, great book, and it's a really important book.
And I will say, because I'm not doing in-person signings for the moment, if you buy a book and you send me a DM or a private message on Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever, and with a picture of the book, I will send you a signed book plate that I had personally made, and they have a little outline of John Quincy Dog Adams up at the top. So, send me those pictures, and you will get your personalized JQDA dog plate.
Perfect.
Can I have a dog print on it, too? That would be good.
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
Excellent. Well, we hope you'll come back, Lindsay. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you so much. I hope you guys stay well and stay safe in these absolutely crazy times.
Yeah, likewise.
Until next time, Frank.
Yeah,
cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.